Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon, and we're the Old Dogs.
If you've got about 20 minutes, grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us.
In this episode, the Old Dogs ramble about dealing with trash. We introduce you to a new class of religious affiliation, the nuns. We angst over the mountain of human flesh that is overwhelming Mount Everest, and Paul tries to stump Jim again with little success. The Old Dog's conversation is with Eva Archer-Smith, a corporate coach who is accomplishing even more in her 70s. Stay with us. Well, Paul, I'd love to ask you what's on your mind, but I'm afraid what you're going to say.
Well, even if you don't ask, I'm going to share. You know, we did a piece in the current episode about trash being left behind on Mount Everest. And that started me thinking about trash we leave behind in our everyday lives. And I'm wondering, what efforts do you make about reducing your waste footprint?
Boy, that's a real good question.
Well, thanks, Jim.
Unlike my question, it's not just recycling. It's the things that I no longer need that aren't necessarily stuff that you would put in a recycling bin. I really,
like adult diapers, or what are you referring to?
You had to bring that up, didn't you? No, it's items like furniture, for example. About a year ago, I closed my office, and I had a lot of furniture in that office. Some of that equipment has found its way into my studio here at home. The rest of it, I had to get rid of. And so I had to do a number of things. I advertised equipment and sold it. What I could not sell, I kept. And in terms of furniture, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there is a huge glut of office furniture now because so many offices are closing.
Yes.
People are working from home. And yet there are services, and I found one near my home, that will take your furniture, for example, on consignment, and find somebody who is willing to buy it cheaply, of course. And then you get a small percentage, say a quarter of the proceeds. And then if they don't sell it, they donate it to a particular charity that can use it. And I'm hoping that that charity isn't the city landfill.
Yeah, dream on there. Now, what I have tried to do is I have practiced recycling for many years now.
Me too.
But what I'm not as good at is making sure that the initial purchases I make use less non-biodegradable containers, for example.
Yeah, packaging is still pretty awful.
Oh, it sure is. Yes, yes, yes.
I think that's a nice background conversation to have with yourself when you purchase things. Sometimes it's unavoidable. You know, you get something that is packaged in a plastic bubble and inside it's wrapped in something else. And you have all that junk left from when you unwrap it.
We should take those back to the store and leave it, just the wrappings, on the shelf.
On the shelf. Maybe somebody will buy that. Well, then, of course, the other problem is that even when we do recycle stuff, there are some dangers inherent in the recycling process.
Right. And there's no way to really verify that, but I've heard the same stories.
Okay.
Particularly recycling plastics is a messy business. Mm-hmm. You know, it releases small particles of plastic in the air.
And in the water.
That we end up in our bodies. We are the Earth's filtering mechanism. No telling how many things I have filtered out of the air or water. And I don't want to know, actually. Yeah, well, maybe if you force manufacturers and restaurants to recycle their own waste, not just put it out there, but what if they had the responsibility for recycling? Maybe we would see some efforts made to reduce the packaging. In fact, they might even be handing you the hamburgers hand to hand. Can I have a napkin? No, you can't have a napkin. Use your sleeve.
Right.
Recently, National Public Radio presented a survey from Pew Research that showed that people with no religious affiliation now outnumber any religiously affiliated groups.
These folks are called nuns, and they are not a uniform faction. They comprise three distinct groups: atheists, agnostics, and those who describe themselves as nothing in particular.
Most nuns believe in a higher power, but they don't attend any religious services. They favor science over religion, but know that science has limitations explaining some of life's mysteries.
Nuns are less civically engaged, meaning they are less likely to vote. They are also less likely to volunteer in their communities than religiously affiliated adults.
They also skew younger, male, and white. The conclusion is people of color are more likely to say religion is important in their life. Also, women tend to be more religious than men.
So, why is this important? Well, the group is increasing in numbers. In 2007, they numbered 16% of Americans. Today, they are at 28% and growing. They're also strongly liberal and vote Democratic. So, don't be surprised if nuns have an impact on politics in the near future, if they bother to vote. The Washington Post suggests that Mount Everest is being overwhelmed with human waste and other litter from climbers. In a 2022 report, climbers in the spring left behind 35,000 pounds of poop on Everest and two nearby peaks.
You can blame adventure tourism for this wasteful problem. Increasing numbers of inexperienced climbers want to claim a climb up Everest. The onslaught has resulted in the past in lines of climbers waiting their turn.
The government of Nepal has been enforcing laws to stop littering on Everest since 2015. Climbers also pay a trash deposit, which is returned if they bring back 20 pounds of non-biodegradable trash. But these laws don't cover excrement.
And so the biggest change is, starting this year, climbers will have to carry poop bags on their climb. Now, I assume this will be on the honor system. I can't imagine Nepal wants to police body functions.
But the real issue is just too many climbers. The government has resisted reducing the number of climbing permits since Nepal is a poor country and it depends on mountaineering and tourism. The cost to climb can be over $100,000 per person.
Crowding has made the climb more dangerous in the last few years. In 2019, a human traffic jam on the mountain resulted in 11 deaths. And by the end of the last climbing season in May, 17 people were presumed dead.
But the deaths haven't scared off the inexperienced climbers that want a trophy climb to the highest point on Earth. Maybe the requirement to bring back 20 pounds of trash and all your poop will take some of the luster off climbing Everest. What do you think, Paul?
We can only hope. As a point of clarification, our Stump the Older Old Dog feature is not an attempt to humiliate seniors in general.
Just me.
Yeah, it is, however, an attempt to humiliate one senior in particular, the older old dog, Jim Conlin. Our stumping topic for this episode is obscure presidential facts, collected from interestingfacts.com. All questions will be true or false. Are you ready, Jim?
You bet I am, Paul.
I can see that sweat pouring down your brow. Question number one. Abraham Lincoln once considered joining the Donner Party. True or false?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, he brought his own cook kit.
Well, the answer is true. He briefly considered it, but his wife Mary stopped the consideration. Question number two. Martin Van Buren was the only president whose first language wasn't English. True or false?
True. It was Swahili.
You're giving the right answers for the wrong reasons. The answer is true. Van Buren was raised in Kinderhook, New York, and the community was Dutch-speaking. Question number three. No U.S. president has been an only child. True or false?
I'm going to say false.
The answer is true.
Boo.
Although some half-brothers figure in the calculation.
See, I was thinking about the half-brothers, Paul.
There's your problem. You got to quit thinking, Jim. Question number four. Well, President Ulysses S. Grant was arrested for speeding. True or false?
That's true. He was riding his buggy on the wrong side of the road at 10 miles an hour. That was 5 miles an hour over the speed limit.
Actually, the answer is true, and it was in his buggy that he was charged for speeding. And finally, question number five. Andrew Jackson kept a 1,400-pound wheel of cheese on display in the White House. True or false?
That is absolutely true.
Yes, the answer is true. The big cheese was a gift from a supporter. It was awkward to move, so it was left in the foyer of the White House.
For how long?
It was finally... Huh?
How many years did it live in the White House? Well,
more than one. It was finally consumed at Jackson's last public reception. And the score for the older old dog, 4 right, 1 wrong, you're improving.
And I just gave you that one false answer just to make you feel better, Paul.
Yeah, right, right. Some of your answers were way off the charts.
Huh.
Okay, but you did say true and false.
Yes, I did. Eva Archer-Smith has always been interested in how people behave when they're part of a group. This curiosity led her to a successful career in coaching company employees to work better together. But just when many women think about retiring, Eva found new energy in turning her attention to coaching individuals within corporations. She has found so much enjoyment and success in this work that she's still at it in her 70s. Eva, it seems that whatever precisely you've been involved with, it has had to do with people and your ability to manage people, to coach people, to be better persons. And this is within the corporate framework, right?
Exactly. And, you know, ever since I was a little girl, I was interested in how people were communicating with each other. So I worked for the school newspaper. I went to Syracuse University. I studied journalism. I worked for newspapers. I worked for NPR. And then I went into corporate communications and marketing. And I thought I would do that forever. And then something happened in a boardroom in London. And I'd made my presentation. And then the CEO had stood up and he said, "We're going to do this. We're going to change this." And I remember thinking, that guy's not going to do any of this. And I wasn't being negative or critical, but I had gotten to know him and his team, and they didn't trust each other. They didn't talk to each other. They were change resistant. And I decided in that moment that I wasn't going to do that anymore. And I would do something different that helped people get out of their own way. And sometimes that had to do with having more confidence. Sometimes it had more to do with it being willing to fail, with remembering when they've been successful. But I've always been fascinated with the development of us as human beings within this structure called a company or an organization. That's always interested me. So that's what I do.
You know, when you talk about getting out of your own way, I come across that phrase quite often, and I would like to find out, what is it about getting in their way? Is it different for everybody, or is there some common denominator that you find they're engaged in?
I am finding that we as people, as humans, are remarkably similar and remarkably different. And so there's always something that can join us, and there's a lot that's different. So let me talk about what the commonalities
are. Yeah, please.
One of them is that most of our early brain wiring has happened in the context of an educational system. And the educational system, I think research says like 95% of the work we do in education is about finding the right answer. And so we become very molded to have the right answer, for people to be right and wrong, for wanting to know everything. And that's one that makes people get in their way, right? Especially living in the age that we're living in now, where everything is complex, where there's two sides, there's 10 sides to everything. And we now live in an age of polarity. So that's one of it. One of them is sort of, we have to get out of our own way in terms of what we consider conflictual.
Hmm.
I think the other thing that happens is that we think we know people. And there's been, you know, a lot of my work is in the area of emotional intelligence. And a lot of people have begun to think of emotional intelligence as, oh, yeah, I know what you're feeling. I know what you're thinking. And they say it in a way that portrays like insight. Well, it's not. And, you know, there's no leadership competency called mind reading. You know, the competency is asking and listening,
mm-hmm.
and realizing that we might know what we see, but we don't know what their intention is.
Mm. Well, okay, but given the challenges now of getting out of our own way, challenges that are exacerbated by both education and experience and age, especially age, how do we overcome this impediment of being in our own way?
I have to say that one of the reasons that I was so interested in being on this podcast is I just love the name of it. Isn't it Old Dogs Should Do New Tricks? Or
new tricks for old dogs, right.
A lot of us, as we get older, sort of say, I'm kind of too old to change. This is who I am. And again, this is polarity. I love who you are. I love the uniqueness of you. But sometimes that's a language that doesn't work in this country that we're in. And I've been lucky enough to be part of a small group of executive coaches that have studied with neurobiologists some of the new things we're learning about the brain. And so when people say to me now, can I really change? And I, no matter what age they are, I said, you know, I used to say, optimistically, oh, yes, I believe you can change. Now I say, absolutely, because we know now that the brain changes when we behave differently. And so the real key is curiosity, right? And curiosity is a very vulnerable thing. And those of us who have done something for a long time or gone to school for a long time, God forbid, gotten a PhD, you know, that knowing and being expert is so much a part of our identity that being curious is a very vulnerable place to be. But building an open heart and a sense of curiosity is the key.
So if somebody says to us, I want to be a coach, we'll send them to you, Eva. And you straighten them out. Kind of behind that question is there is a field opening up for coaching and advising elders.
Yes, yes. And in fact, we were asked by the New York founding branch to create an organization in Houston called the Transition Network, which was for sort of women over 50 who were transitioning out of their main career but, you know, didn't want to roll bandages. Not that there's anything wrong with rolling bandages, but they didn't want to do that. And then there were some offshoots. And so for 4 or 5 years, I led a little group called Your Spiritual Journey After 50. And there was a woman there who was the head of communication for the Houston Grand Opera. And she began, she was always in the arts and was a violinist. And she calls it your encore, coaching for your encore.
Mm-hmm.
And she specifically works with them on their way out, accountants, lawyers, anything. And she has a wonderful process to do that. And it is really, what do you do for your third act? I want to tell you why I'm still very much working at 73. So I told you the story that I started coaching in my mid-50s. I was widowed at 57 and of course, just kind of kept working. And I've been thinking lately, why won't I retire? And I think the reason is that most people, when they retire, say, now I have a chance to do what I'm passionate about. I just happened to find my passion in that boardroom in London about 25 years ago. So this is what I would want to do. Now, I am trying to have more discretionary time, not to be so busy. I do think that comes with age. But some of us have found that thing already. And for me to give that up to paint, which I couldn't paint anything, when I saw that, it relieved me. Because I thought, okay, it's not that you're doing retirement wrong. It's that you want to keep doing this, but maybe at a slower pace and not so often. So starting last year, I've started taking the summer off. And people know that I won't be available this year, July and August. Last year it was June and July. And I might take December off. Next year too. And so it's there's the what and there's the how, right? And some of us have to change the what, and some of us just need to change the how.
Well, you know, we've interviewed quite a few people for our podcast, and we have interviewed several people like yourself who have discovered their passion. It's not that retirement gives them an opportunity. They've always enjoyed what they were doing. They've just reshaped it, as you said.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Yeah. Well, you're a lucky person.
Now,
it also raises the question and of powerful executives that are near the end, either because of a required retirement age, have a difficult transition.
Yeah.
And studies have shown a short lifespan if they don't master it.
Yes, yes.
So is that part of your work to help ease that transition? Or?
So that's an interesting question. Here's how I would say that, is that, you know, we hear this bantered around everywhere in corporations, but it's actually very legitimate, and it's called work-life balance. And when I work with the leaders that I work with, I remind them that work-life balance isn't just some sort of idyllic sort of concept. It's actually an identified leadership competency. And so early on, you know, when I'm working with them, is how are you balancing your life? What gives you joy? This is one of the things that the assessments do, right? Like where really is your heart? So that there maybe isn't quite such a divide between their work, like they stop their work and they start their life. I mean, a lot of executives want to, you know, come back as consultants or sit on boards, and that's great if that's what they want to do. But a lot of it is that they're just trying to recreate their life as a corporate executive. But, you know, you can't retire and then figure out who you are. Ironically, this work from home, they were forced to enjoy a kind of a work-life balance. And it didn't mean that they didn't work, but, you know, you don't work unfocused for 8 or 9 or 10 hours, you know, and the fact that they could take a breath and have lunch with their mate or pick their kids up from school, I think it's really changed everything.
If there were, let's say, I'm going to say three questions that an individual person in his or her later years could ask themselves to get out of their own way and enjoy the remainder of their lives.
Yes, I think, and I would put it all in the framework, Jim, of being your own witness, and that your life is your lab. So what I would ask people to do, and I ask myself to do this often when I'm, you know, kind of feeling off, when are you so into something that time flies? One, what activities create joy or diminish joy, right? And what have you done that day makes you feel great at the end of it?
like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.